Welcome back to Dear Skylar, my show where we talk to all kinds of incredible people about topics that I'm asked about as a transgender educator and author, things like gender, sexuality, race, all the anti-trans legislation, everything in between and beyond. You might know that this year, over 500 anti-trans pieces of legislation were introduced around the country in about 44 states, not concentrated in the Bible Belt or the South, all over the United States. These bills attack trans people in sports, in healthcare, access to gender-affirming, life-saving healthcare, in bathrooms, in education systems, encroaching on our very dignity and ability to live in public. And one of the questions I get frequently is, why now? Why all of these bills, right? Record-breaking number of anti-trans legislation. Why is it happening now? And today's episode is addressing just that. With my friend Chase Strangio, lead ACLU attorney on transgender rights, we're going to talk about the answer to this question. Why are there so many anti-trans bills? Chase is an amazing person that I've learned personally a lot from, and I'm so excited to bring you this conversation. I'm really excited that you're here, Chase. I know who you are, and I know a lot about who you are, and we've talked for years, but I'm wondering for the audience if you could give a quick just explanation of who you are, where you come from, pronouns, and such, whatever short bio you want to give us.
Well, thank you for having me. It's nice to be here. It's nice to be sitting with you. That feels really good in these times. So my name is Chase. I use he, him, or they, them pronouns. I am a lawyer. I work at the National Office of the ACLU, the LGBTQ and HIV Project. I've worked at the ACLU for a little over 10 years, and I work on mostly trans justice issues, lobbying in state legislatures to try to stop anti-trans bills, litigating cases in state and federal court across the country, and then doing other more creative projects and media, public education, the range of tactics to try to continue to disrupt the anti-trans landscape and build beautiful spaces for trans communities.
Yeah, that last bit, build beautiful spaces for trans communities, so needed right now. As you are explaining all the things that you do, the amazing things that you do, I think the shortest way to say it is you are saving lives. And I think that, you know, whenever we both do this work of fighting anti-translation. And whenever I think about what you do in terms of being in the courthouses, litigating these bills, I'm exhausted thinking about it. So I just wanted to say, I'm so grateful for all the work that you do. And I know so many people are. I feel like you're carrying a ton on your shoulders. So I suppose what I first wanted to ask you is how do you feel? How is your heart feeling? How are you holding up?
I think a lot of things at once. And so first and foremost, I continue to feel really grateful and somewhat just humbled to get to do this work. I think that there is something incredible about getting to fight alongside your community and use the tactics that you have at your disposal. And we can constantly evaluate the utility of those various tactics, but just to be in engagement does always feel like an unbelievable privilege. And then I feel tired. I think I do feel tired. I mean, I've been doing this work in various ways for about 20 years. I've been at the ACLU for a little over 10. And it is, exhausting to be confronted with the cyclical vitriol. And in the moments when it feels like it's escalating, that can feel exhausting. And then I think about all of the people in our communities who have fought for so much longer, who have lived through so much, and we have been here before. We'll find our way through it. And so even in the exhaustion, I do have just such gratitude and hope and love.
I think that's so important. And I think it's something that, at least for me, is that resiliency, or rather that hope, I suppose, allows us to kind of work through the constant barrage of attacks. And recently, I know you commented on this as well, but we had a very clear call for the eradication of trans people. And we've been talking about this. I know you and I've done lives, we've done posts, we've talked about this many times, where people are saying these bills are about protecting children. The bills are about protecting women, supposedly, right? But in reality, they're truly trying to eradicate people from trans people from public life. And you have said that directly before a recent commentator said that. So I was curious if you could talk a little bit more about where we came from and why we're here now, with commentators directly saying
transgenderism, quote unquote, must be eradicated from public life.
Yeah, I mean, I remember in 2016 when we started to see the first onslaught of anti-trans bathroom bills, I started talking about it as this isn't about bathrooms, this isn't about safety, this isn't about privacy, this is about pushing trans people out of public life. And that is how we were talking about it then. I remember when Laverne Cox and I were doing media in 2016 when Gavin Grimm's case had gone up to the Supreme Court. And he was, at the time, a trans boy who was excluded from the boys' restroom at his school. The ACLU first filed that lawsuit in 2015. Mm. So we're talking 8 years ago.
Yeah, I remember.
And so at that point, it was easy to see how people were falling into the trap of sort of debating, you know, well, what happens in the bathroom and what's this or what's that? And I was like, no, like, take a step back. This isn't about the bathroom. This isn't about anything to do with the bathroom. And if we get sucked up in that rhetoric and the terms that the other side is setting, we're going to lose sight of what this is really about, which is about the type of eliminationist language that we're now hearing quite explicitly from the main stage at CPAC and elsewhere. But it has always been that. And they've used these methodical strategies to try to distract from the central goal, which has been to sort of claim that being trans is something to get rid of. And we've seen it in various manifestations. And I think we're at a very critical point in our ability to fight back against this.
What does it feel like to have seen that in 2015? And I remember when Gavin Grimm's case hit the press, and I remember being very upset about it as somebody who's struggled my whole life with bathrooms until I transitioned and finally was able to use the men's bathroom. So I remember that case, and I remember many people talking about what it meant, right? And now we're here with the explicitness now brought to national stages. How does it feel for that lack of change, or rather change to the worst, to have occurred over those 8 years? I mean, I know I could share my feelings, but I'm curious as somebody who's been there litigating the whole time.
You know, it's one of these things that we do have inertia and complacency. And I think part of it is, in fact, perhaps the over-reliance on legal movements and this idea that we can keep having this sort of incremental pushback against what's happening instead of taking a step back and saying, well, what are the real sort of movement goals that we need to mobilize around? And I think what we're seeing now in a lot of different spaces, and this is very analogous to what we've seen in the abortion space, where, you know, it was warnings after warnings, Roe's going to be overturned. People were called hysterical. There was a certain amount of disbelief. And then it was overturned, and that's where we are. And then people become somewhat resigned. And I think it's similar here, where there were all the alarms, the communities most impacted say, this is going to happen. I know it's going to happen. And they're called hysterical. The Overton window shifts to the right. And then all of a sudden we become used to completely unacceptable terms of living. And so I really worry about what our complacency does for how we end up both accepting conditions of our lives and then also losing sort of the most important demands of our liberatory visions.
Yeah. How do we fight that complacency? Because I know for myself, you know, there are months when I feel motivated to post about every bill that comes up. And I have not made a single post pretty much recently about bills that have come up that's a specific bill, because first of all, there's way too many. I can't possibly post about all of them, but I used to feel much more motivated to raise awareness. And I wouldn't say that I've become complacent, but I would say there's this, what is the word? It's almost this like deep heaviness right in my chest that says, what's a post going to do? What's talking about going to do? What's fighting going to do? And I know you fought through that for decades, so I'm curious how you do that.
I mean, I think it's a few things. I do think we have to be gentle and tender with ourselves and recognize that we, as individuals, we have limits to what we can do. And I think especially in the United States and the capitalism that we live under and the individualism that is such a, I think, destabilizing part of life here. We do have to recognize that this is sort of a community, communal endeavor. We can't, nobody's going to do it alone. We are limited in what we can do. So A, we just have to be tender with ourselves. And then B, I do think that we, you know, need to be, you know, and it's connected to the first point, collective in our response. And one of the things that's so deeply frustrating is that, you know, it's really hard to help people see that this is not about trans people. I mean, in some sense it is, but it's also not. It's so much bigger. It's about what is the role of government? What is the project that our opponents are trying to bring forth? And it's a project of fascism, and it's a project that is about expanding the ability of the government to control people's movements, people's bodies, people's families, people's education, in the service of structures of power that are invested in the status quo, and invested in maintaining the hierarchies that have dominated, you know, the Western imperial empires for centuries. This is not a new way of controlling people. And so I really do want people to recognize that this isn't about, oh, are we going to, you know, protect trans healthcare or abortion exclusively? This is also about what kind of government are we going to be living under?
What kind of autonomy and freedom
generally
do we have? Yes. Right. And I think that's something, you know, that I think a lot of people miss is they're so laser focused on one particular legislative bill or one particular state or even one particular population of people. And I think when I say protect trans kids, what I really mean is like, let's protect freedom. Let's protect bodily autonomy. Let's protect everybody's individual right to self-determination, because it's not about queer kids. It's not about trans kids. It's not about sports. It's not about women. It's not about, you know, even Black folks. It's about all of what that represents in terms of, you know, the book bans, the Black History Month bans, the attacks on Black votership. Like it's like you said, it's invested in maintaining power and consolidating that power in the hands of cis white straight men. For the most part. So,
and it's always been that way. I think, you know, one of the things that, you know, I'm asked about a lot is sort of, well, what is the role of the legal system? And you know, I think it's really important to acknowledge that the legal system is responsible for a lot of this, and our Constitution is responsible for a lot of this. The United States does not have robust principles of bodily autonomy generally, and of course the United States doesn't, because we have a Constitution that was founded to maintain the literal ownership of human beings. You can't have central notions of autonomy and freedom in a legal structure that was built around controlling other humans. And that is central to our legal structure. So we will never, if our movements are always reverting back to the law for notions of freedom and liberation, they will always be constrained by those foundational structures of the United States, right. Which is why we have to be more expansive in our thinking.
Right. So how do you, I mean, that was so profound the way you explained that. I mean, the Constitution's written to protect slavery, right? Protect it, written by enslavers to protect slavery. So if we go back to the law as a lawyer for you, how do you exercise that expansive thinking, and how would you recommend that especially our allies enact that kind of expansive thinking that goes beyond the law?
I think for me, what I think about is my role as a lawyer is to delay and minimize the harm that the state is able to enact on individuals and communities so that individuals and communities can have more space to construct alternatives to what this current legal set of formations will allow. And so I don't think about going to court to bring liberation for our communities. I don't think about going and asking for a law that is representative of what I believe justice to be. Mm. I go to court to say, you can't do this horribly destructive thing, at least for a little while, recognizing that there are very significant limitations, so that people can keep building and dreaming and taking care of each other. And within those formations is where we will find the path forward, in the caring for each other and in the imagination of what does it look like to actually believe in autonomy, to actually believe in, you know, the embodiment that everyone wants and dreams of. Because yes, I believe in demanding from the state many, many things. I believe in stopping the state from doing many, many things, but this state is not going to set us free. And so we can't keep saying things like, well, we need to get our rights, because rights are state created. Rights aren't going to feed us. They're not going to help us dream of ways to care for each other. Rights are, tie us to the state in constructions of both injury and in demands of assimilation, which is why I think we just have to be bigger in our thinking.
State won't give us our rights, I suppose, than we do, right? Or when, or maybe that begs the question of what even is a right?
Yeah.
You know, right is something that is sanctioned by the state as something that we are supposed to have. But if we just are, as opposed to supposed to have, you know, what does that bring us? I think it's beautiful.
And like, yeah, just think about how much more imaginative we can be. I mean, I think in the US, you know, our entire framework of equality is incredibly limited because we don't have a lot of things that are guaranteed to us. We don't have a guarantee of housing. We don't really have a guarantee of education. We definitely don't have a guarantee of healthcare. So what does equality get us? It gets us, which we'll never even have equality, but even that just gets you equal access to something terrible. Mm. Why, you know, I think that's why, you know, we just have to just be more expansive. It doesn't mean we're going to get there tomorrow.
Right.
It just means that we have to think a little bigger
right.
about what is it? What is it that we want to sustain us?
There's a quote that I was thinking, that I'm thinking of from a book that I read recently. It's called How Far the Light Reaches by Sabrina Imbler. They're talking about animals, actually. They have a huge, I promise this is relevant. They're talking about marine life, and there's a quote where they're talking about cuttlefish, and cuttlefish are able to like morph and change their colors based on backgrounds or whatever to camouflage themselves. And they write something like, I want to know when a cuttlefish morphs when it's not in fear. What does it look like to define morphing or changing when it's in community, when it's about sex, when it's about happiness, when it isn't about fear. And they write something like, and I'm not interested in calling it a disguise. And that quote was just like the, I'm not interested in calling it a disguise, defining queerness, defining our rights, defining trans is by what we don't have or by the harm we're experiencing, defining our rights by this box that the state gave us to say, this is the, you know, the menu of what you're allowed to have essentially. Well, what if we just had the ingredients and not the menu?
Yeah.
What else could we create? That's kind of what I hear you asking.
No, absolutely. And just what if we took a step back and started to say not, oh, what can we ask of the state, but what is it that we dream inside ourselves? And I think that example of the cuttlefish is really beautiful. And I even think just the reframing. I was listening to Megan Rapinoe's speech at the Time Women event, and just her saying, instead of just, you know, I want to protect trans people, it was like, no, I want to thank trans communities for what they've given to me, to the expansiveness that has been bestowed to us. Mm. And so I just think that if we center our joy and our power, that is a reimagination that we need to be doing, because it helps us rethink what's happening. So Jillian Brandstetter, who works with me at the ACLU, often says, you know, they don't want to ban gender affirming healthcare because it's not working. They want to ban it because it is working.
Mm.
And that, you know, trying to remind ourselves what this is about is the power that we have to challenge everything people believe to be true.
Yeah.
And that scares people tremendously. But how powerful and beautiful is that to say, the world told me a set of constraints could not be defied, and I defied it anyway.
You were talking about like the words you were using: reimagination, imagine, dream, expansive. A lot of those make me think of childhood, or at least myself in childhood, when I hadn't quite yet learned who I was supposed to be. I hadn't quite yet solidified what this box was that I was built under, I suppose, or built within. And I felt like I had this ability to dream about what I needed, what I wanted, what my joy felt like, way more so than I did in my late teens, and something I've had to sort of rediscover in my 20s. And so I'm curious if you can tell me any kind of story or memory about when you were a kid and you were sort of able to dream, and how that maybe has helped you now.
I think one of the things that I find really sad is I don't remember so much of my childhood, and I'm not even sure why. I think I'm like, it wasn't like I had such a terrible childhood. I think though, what was true for me is that I couldn't imagine a future. Mm-hmm. So it limited even sort of the way my brain connects to that time of my life. But relevant to this moment was that sports was my way of connecting to my body and to my mm-hmm. sense of a more expansive set of possibilities. And so I never really knew quite where to position myself. But participating in sports was my way of sort of setting myself free. And that, especially when I was younger, just being able to sort of say, well, this is a place where, you know, my body can be connected to things that aren't being scrutinized in the same way. Other ways. And I would learn that as we got older. But I think the sort of childhood athletics was so central to my ability to sort of grow into myself. And it's one of the reasons why I find so unbelievably devastating and insidious these attacks on trans participation in sports, because it's just yet another way that the state is trying to cut people off from the possibilities of embodiment and connection to our bodies. And it's so hard to lose that.
Several months ago, I was with a bunch of trans kids at a trans athlete meetup thing. The youngest was 5 or 6, like almost not like a human yet, you know what I mean? Like not really talking full sentences almost. And the oldest was 18, but most of them were like 11 to 12. And it was this beautiful 3-day weekend where they got to play sports. They'd come from all over the country, many from Texas, from Florida and other states that have banned trans children from playing sports. And they played together. And it was like this like unbelievably beautiful and so painful experience for me. And there was a couple other trans athletes there. And it was beautiful because we watched these kids just being kids, right? And because they were all trans, they all got it. And there was no like, oh, you're this or I'm that. It was just, they were just playing. And then the pain was that we all knew that these kids were going to go back to their states where they couldn't play. Where, you know, there was this one kid who sat to talk to me about how she didn't want to play on the boys team the next year when she went to middle school, and how she was going to have to quit because of it. And she was so upset about it. And I was like, this is what America is afraid of. Yeah. Like this child who cannot even really speak in full sentences because they're so young. And I think about that. I think about little Chase. I think about myself and how sports have been so central to how I found myself. I've connected to my body. And it's so painful. I'm curious what sport you played, and kind of, can you walk us through a memory of playing it and how maybe you still play something like that now?
Yeah. So, I mean, I started playing soccer when I was really young. I played soccer.
I'm horrible at soccer.
I mean, I probably am now, to be honest. I did give it up. So I played.
You're better than me.
I started really young, and it was my whole childhood was school and soccer. And those were the ways that I sort of channeled everything else. And I played on, you know, 3 different teams starting in around, you know, 5th grade. I traveled, and it was a social place outside of school. It was a place where I was able, you know, to set a distinct set of goals and purposes, and having a team and teammates. And that's not to say that there wasn't very destructive things that, you know, being someone who grew up in girls' sports, I can see so many ways that we could be investing in girls' sports in a more productive way, rather than claiming that the one and only way to invest in women and girls' sports is to ban a subset of women and girls from sports. What a classic thing for us to do in the United States is to have actual no material investment in something and just scapegoating and punishment is a very distinctly USian thing to do. But
it's not funny.
It's funny because what else are you going to do? Perverse of how we just operate here. But it was, I mean, it was everything to me. And I will say, you know, I tore my ACL really young, as a sophomore in high school, and ended up having 3 knee surgeries before the end of high school. And it was, you know, I think one of the things that I learned was that there was an underinvestment in athletics for girls, and it wasn't about trans girls, and it wasn't about any one subset of girls. It was about systems and the way in which systems set people up to fail or not. And I, you know, I learned really young too the devastation of losing access to something that you love. In my case, it was through injury. But it was so painful and it was so hard in my sophomore year of high school to be, you know, sidelined because I was recovering from surgery, and that, you know, affected my mental health so greatly, because in high school, especially when, you know, you're in the throes of puberty, you're trying to figure out who you are, you're already managing, like for me, you know, it was in the 90s. I had no examples of actually of queerness or transness, and sports was where I found just a place to be. And so to lose that was so painful. And that is something that we're taking away from kids. I mean, like you were saying, it's one of the many iterations of what these anti-trans bills do to cut trans people generally, and particularly trans youth, off from their participation in the world and their bodies. I mean, think about it. We're focusing on medical care, sports, and bathrooms. And these are sort of fundamental ways that individuals find connection to the base needs of their bodies. And that is just excruciating and connects to the overall goal, which is to eradicate transness by cutting us off from our bodies in any number of ways. And in so doing, sabotaging our ability, not just to survive, but to dream of our survival. And I think the other thing I'll say is that is also connected, of course, to the ways in which our stories are being shut out of libraries and schools, our stories both in the form of books, but then also in the form of just talking. So these are sort of different iterations of cutting people off from what embodiment can and should mean.
You said something, you said the dream of, it cuts us off from dreaming of survival. And I was thinking how survival isn't enough either.
Yeah.
And you know, one of the things you had said earlier as well about not being able to dream of your own future, to imagine your own future. I think in many ways I had a good childhood, but I didn't know how to imagine beyond that. And I think the only thing I could imagine actually was swimming, was my sport. And the only place I could imagine myself was in the pool, because there's, at least for me, there's this, when you're underwater, it's almost as if you don't even have a body. There's this like intense embodiment because I'm only swimming and I'm just this action of body. But at the same time, I don't see my body. I'm just, you know, this act of swimming. And I remember thinking, well, that's all I have, you know, that's my future. And I think as I've grown older, I'm 26 now, and I've met people who I would consider my elders. I don't mean old, but my elders, even you would be somebody I'd consider because you're older than me. And that has been so, I don't want to even say like life-saving, yes, but again, beyond survival, it's been life-giving, because I see trans people who are living their lives. And it's not, you know, I know that you do so much amazing work for the trans community, but you're also a parent. You're also somebody who loves soccer. You also wear cool shirts. Like, you also have a life that isn't just about being trans. And I remember the first time I met somebody and really like connected with another trans person who actually also a person of color who's older than me. I went home and I just bawled. Like, I just was so moved by being able to see myself in the future. And I was wondering if you have a memory of the first time you did begin to imagine your own future.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, it was so stark, because when I first started to sort of understand myself as a trans person, a trans masculine person, was in the very early 2000s. And I've talked about this before, but at the time, the only trans person that I knew of was Brandon Tina. Mm. And he was murdered, you know, and that was right. What I knew. And there was, I didn't have internet. There wasn't social media really. It was like trying to remember what, I mean, like I went on like Friendster in 2000 or the early
2000s. I don't even know what that is.
Yeah. Okay. So I am definitely your elder. Exactly. But actually it was like MySpace and Friendster were the first place I started to see trans people. And this is another thing that really upsets me about this moment is the way in which the right in particular has weaponized our desire to find community online and, you know, in person as examples of contagion of transness rather than us seeking out the comfort of knowing that we're not alone. I mean, what the most human thing in the world is to find kinship. And so this becomes pathologized and weaponized against us in ways that are so destructive, because I didn't, you know, so many trans young people are totally and completely isolated from transness. And that was certainly true, you know, in the early 2000s and before, when we also didn't have social media and the internet to look to. And so I remember graduating from college, moving back to Boston, where I was from, and meeting, you know, trans people and becoming part of political community. And then everything just felt totally different. All of a sudden it was like I was able to sort of exist in my body and sort of actually start to map out a set of goals for myself. Like I had never met a trans person. I never would have become a lawyer because I never would have known that I could take another step forward in the world. And so then I started to be in community. I went to law school, and sort of started on the path that I've been on, you know, for the last 18 years.
Do you remember the first trans person you met? Not, you know, watching Boys Don't Cry, but the actual moment when you met a person in real life and you were able to be like, that's me.
I think it was more a process, because I've been trying to sort of remember, and it was actually, I went from rural Iowa where I went to college, and then I got to, and then there were so many queer and trans people, and I was like, oh my God, there's whole communities. And I just felt like I never want to leave this feeling. And I basically never did. I was like, I never put myself in another situation where I wasn't with all queer and trans people. Mm. You know, it was like and even in college, I was with all queer people, but you know, from 2004 to the present, I am a queer and trans supremacist. Like I will basically ensure that at any given time, I just will always be immersed in community, because that's where I'm happy and that's what makes me feel creative and excited and joyful. And so it was actually not a single person. It was just so many people, and realizing that there's not just one way to be trans. There's not just one way to be queer. It's actually part of a political movement. I was very much in the context, connected to transness in the context of prison abolition and in the context of organizing. And so for me, it was just so dynamic and felt so much like the home I wanted to be in forever, and have made sure of that. And one of the reasons why I'm so committed to the work that I do is because I want the state to stop trying to annihilate the spaces that people make that are so unbelievably beautiful.
I love that you surround yourself with queer and trans people. It's one of the things that I found myself doing, not even really purposefully, especially through the pandemic. I think everybody went through a life crisis during the pandemic. I think the world did. For me, a lot of that focus actually was, who do I want to surround myself with? Who do I want to talk to? Because when the pandemic hit, everything went online and I got sick of texting people back. We're at 3 years from the pandemic, and I pretty much, my top like 10 text people on my phone, all trans or queer. And I noticed that about a year ago, and I was like, huh, that makes sense. Yeah. Nice.
Yeah.
But I think there's something really special to be said about the privilege that we have to be able to access that. You said you grew up in Boston, you went back home there. I live in Boston now. We've talked about me randomly accidentally meeting your dad before I met you.
Forgot about that. Yes.
randomly that he was my Uber driver one day and he started talking about you.
Which is terrifying, but also amazing.
He didn't say anything weird. but in any case, my point is that the privilege we have to be able to connect to that, I think is something I don't ever want to forget. And it shouldn't be a privilege. Of course, I think that we should be, you know, there are trans people and queer people everywhere. We just don't know that. And I think what you said, there was a beautiful line, and just I want to put it in bold somewhere, which is that it's not like trans contagion, but it's us seeking kinship. And I always get nervous. You and I both do a ton of press interviews. I always get nervous when I want to explain why there is, you know, this plethora of anti-trans bills and what we can do about it. Because part of what I want to say is, well, actually, there's not more of us because we're, you know, becoming trans. We've always been here. We're just finally able to talk about it with each other. But then people twist that and they're saying, you know, well, infecting transness. but like, we're, you know, we're actually just finding people for the first time. I'm curious, when you talk about this, I know you do this with lots of people, how do you communicate to people more specificity about that, or sort of proof that we're not contagious, but we're seeking kinship?
Yeah, I mean, I think we just have to realize that they're trying to make us scared of connecting, of talking, of explaining who we are. And so it is really tricky, because then everything feels like a trap. And because we're debated so routinely, it just becomes a constant set of self-censoring impulses, which is so depressing. Because like, well, they're doing so much to us. I don't want to shrink for you. And I don't want to limit who I am and all of the things that I see and feel and do. And actually, I think one of the things that's so frustrating in general too is this impulse to sanitize experience and humanity. It's like, we are messy and complex, and that I don't want to shy away from that. And I remember talking to a trans young person who I was working with, and you know, so many trans young people's stories are that they met other trans people online. Mm. And I think that there's such this like reflexive fear that plays into this horrible, like, quote unquote, social contagion narrative. But the way, if we actually listen to people explain, it's so deep and beautiful, which is especially all over this country, people are in rural places and they have to leave school and they don't have the ability to move freely in the world because they're afraid of violence and they can't go children. To the bathroom or their children, and they're reliant on other people to move them and take them places, or nobody in their life has resources to do so, or is not supportive. There's a million reasons. And so when you listen to people explain, I've known this about myself for so long, and I didn't know there was anyone else like me. And then when I realized that there was, it opened me up and wanted, you know, it gave me a reason to keep waking up every day and feeling excited about what the day could bring. And, you know, this all makes so much sense. And then, you know, we have the other overlay of, you know, people saying, oh, well, trans young people have poor mental health outcomes. And it's like, well, first of all, that seems like a very logical reaction to the world that we're living in. And also, we know that adolescents in general are not doing well, trans or not. And that's a product of A, the horribly toxic world that we live in, and B, the fact that, you know, we have just got through 3 years of a pandemic. Young
very
people
little resources.
With very little resources, with you know, no support, where people lost relatives and those close to them and caregivers, and we're acting like, oh, what could have possibly happened, or oh, this is unique to this population or this population, instead of saying, well, you know, as human beings, we're tender and reactive, and what if we gave ourselves space to respond to what it feels like to not know what's happening to the world, or to feel like your government is trying to kill you. That's a horrible feeling. And if people find kinship and connection online or anywhere else, we're gonna pathologize it instead of celebrate it. And I think that's so unbelievably devastating. And you see then those of us who are trying to advocate also shying away from explaining what it's like to be who we are, because we're afraid that every step we take will be weaponized against us.
And it is. And I think we have to discard that. I mean, one of the things that you have given me advice on is they're going to twist it, and we have to still be ourselves. I absolutely found life-saving and also life-giving connections on Instagram and on other social media platforms, because I didn't see anybody else like me. And I know you came out before me, and even 8-10 years ago when I came out, there still wasn't a whole lot of community. Yeah. There wasn't this conversation. I didn't know that there was other Korean queer people and trans people, for example. And last night I sat on a panel with eight queer and trans Korean people. And I was like, where have you been? But they've been here. Some of them have been doing work for 20 years, but they like the world, the system doesn't want to let us connect, right? Because when they do, it's powerful. And I just keep thinking about that, because all of yesterday when I was at this panel, I was thinking to myself, why didn't I know that all these people existed beforehand? Why is it so hard to find their work? Why have I not been somehow in community with all these Korean queer folks before now? And the reason is exactly what you're talking about. People are afraid to organize. But for the most part, I actually can't think of a single person who's trans who's come up to me and been like, you know what? I don't know if I'm trans. Can we talk about that? It's almost always, I know I'm trans, now what?
Yeah.
And there are people who question, so I don't want to erase them, of course, and you can question, but most people who are saying I'm trans, I need help, are not saying, am I trans? They're saying, I am, what do I do?
And and we question in silence. I wish we questioned more out loud, but we don't. And so by the time anyone says anything out of fear of rejection, out of fear of violence, out of fear of being told, no, you're not, by people you really don't want to hear that from, you've been thinking about it for years. And so it's like this idea, you know, and the way in which this notion of so-called rapid onset gender dysphoria came into the common discourse is parents were asked, did your child become trans suddenly? And they said, yes, but they never asked the kids. Yeah. And it's like, of course, everything seems sudden when you're not, you know, it might seem sudden to other people, but we've been holding it in silence, in pain for a long time. And I remember, and this is in 2015, I think, or maybe 2016, I was doing The Daily Show. I think it was one of the first trans segments they had ever done that wasn't a joke about trans people. And this was right after Trevor Noah took over, and we were doing a panel, and Peppermint, it was my first time meeting Peppermint, who's one of my close friends. And she was saying that, you know, we have done so much painful soul searching and come to this conclusion about ourselves, you know, against people telling us no, people telling us that they will reject us, that they will hurt us, and that, and we are told that, you know, that we haven't thought this through. But this is through so much deep soul searching and self-interrogation that we often do alone. And so it is so deeply frustrating to hear a conversation about how this is happening in a almost, you know, pandemic way, and that people are being rushed into anything, when the reality is that, and the reason why people are so eager to have trans people actually be listened to, is that there's an interiority to all of this that is never seen or felt if you're not proximate to our experience.
What you're saying about the sort of sudden onset of transness is a phrase I haven't heard yet, but that I've, you know, read people talking about something like that. And even my parents, even from a child who was very gender nonconforming me for my whole childhood, when I told my parents that I was trans, they weren't unsupportive by, you know, many ways, but they were like, what?
Yeah.
and I had played boys baseball. I played boys lacrosse. I played boys soccer. I had only friends who were boys, and I was called he, him pronouns for most of my childhood as a bully. Like, people would bully me with that, but I was received in a very masculine way for most of my childhood. And when I said I was trans, they were like, what? and that it's again, the lack of the interiority, the word you use, the interiority of this imagination, of this exploration, of this self, I think, is so painful for so much of us, and so not obvious to other people that they have to rake through our childhoods to see it.
Yeah.
And if they can't,
then they're like, you're making it up. No way. It's not possible.
Exactly.
And it's like, I mean, and so it's just like, yeah, like, listen to any trans person, and, you know, the number of years they often wait before telling a single person is very significant. And yes, those years have gone down. It used to be like decades.
Right.
And now it's like, oh, I waited 5 years. And now, and then we're sort of acting all of a sudden like, oh my God, these kids are just turning trans suddenly. And it's like, let's just pause for a minute and think about, like, how this actually goes.
Yeah. When I first asked for top surgery or said that I wanted to get top surgery, everybody, all my doctors, I was in a residential treatment center at the time for eating disorder, and all my doctors, all my therapists, all my nurses said no. They said, you have only thought about it for a couple weeks or a couple months or whatever it was at the time. It's too soon. You can't get it. So my parents said no. So I went and tried to do it anyways, and I couldn't get a person to sign the letter. I was privileged enough to be able to cycle through therapists to find a therapist that would finally sign the letter. And I, of course, ended up getting top surgery. But the reason that I'm sharing this is it was so difficult to get it, even as somebody with privilege. And at the point of getting it, the argument was, this is new. You can't do it. It's too soon. And that was when I was 18, about to turn 19. And I had thought about removing my breasts since before they had grown. And nobody knew that.
Yeah.
They just didn't know that that was an interior battle that I had been fighting. I remember panicking when my mom told me that one day I would grow to have breasts and to have hips. And I was like, no, I won't. And she was like, "What? Yes, you will." But that, you know, that,
exactly.
That
like hidden fight. You're struggling. And then yes, because other people think of it in the terms of either their experience or their assumptions, our whole experience of ourselves and our bodies is totally and completely erased and then made in one way or another to be inauthentic or criminal or whatever the societal structures are imposing upon us, depending on many things, like including race, disability, geographic location, proximity to houselessness. There's a million iterations of how this narrative from other people gets imposed upon us. But the idea that we're just like popping up with these in the moment and running off at whatever age to access medical procedures that are totally and completely out of reach for the overwhelming majority of people, by the way, it's just, it's completely counterfactual and actually absurd if we think about it.
Yeah. I know so many people who have spent months, if not years, trying to access gender-affirming healthcare, which is one of the things that's so frustrating about the detransition narrative, which again is not ever to erase the experiences of people who don't fit what I'm about to say. But most people don't detransition. Most people don't regret it. And most people have to fight tooth and nail to even get the care. And I think that goes along with all of the narratives we've been talking about that's twisting facts, right? Yeah. That are just not facts. One of the things I was thinking about, because it's kind of going back to our conversation about contagion versus seeking kinship. Sometimes when people ask me ridiculous questions like, you know, what if you're not trans? I'll say, well, what if I'm not?
Yeah.
When people say, what if it's contagious? I want to say, well, what if it is?
Yeah.
What if this, and it may be not transness, but what if questioning yourself was contagious? What would be so bad about asking yourself, who am I? And I think that's like when you go back to what you were talking about, this whole conversation with sort of the system that is trying to give us this very restricted menu of what we are allowed to access, what rights we can have, what we can dream of, what we can imagine. What would it be like to ask ourselves more than that, right? And so I was curious, as we start to wrap up this conversation, what you hope for trans kids and trans youth to imagine and what you want to sort of, what, I don't know, ingredients you hope that they remember exist when they're given this very restrictive menu of what they're allowed to have.
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, first and foremost, I want trans young people in particular to remember how powerful they are. Mm. And this, you know, this idea of that if there is, you know, something that we're teaching the world, it's that you have the power to imagine beyond the restrictive structures that you're being fed. And that to be told you cannot be who you are, to be told you can only be one or two things, and recognize within yourself other possibilities is incredibly powerful. It's so powerful, in fact, that people are desperate to stop it. And it's sort of the eradication they want is the eradication of possibility, the eradication of dreaming, you know, that overly determined structures are a centerpiece of fascism. And that there's such power to a 5-year-old or a 15-year-old saying, no, I there is something bigger inside me than what you're telling me. And yes, I know that you're in a position of authority and you're telling me this can't be so, but I know it so deeply that I'm going to stand up to you over and over again. Like, what power and what self-awareness to be able to do that. So to trans young people, I just want to say that you have this power and it is beautiful, and that the desire to squash it comes from a deeply destructive place, and you are operating in a deeply restorative place. And so hoping that we sort of center that, you know, the restoration and the creation that comes with transness. And the other thing is that this idea, and I like your point of, you know, what if what we are spreading is that we question things and that we want more for ourselves? Like, that is beautiful. Yeah. And you know, the reality, of course, is that we are all so deeply conditioned to be cisgender and heterosexual that the idea that the contagion that's out there is somehow being trans as opposed to being cis is completely and utterly absurd. Because, you know,
I've never been forced to be trans. I have been actively and repeatedly forced to be cis and to be straight.
Every day.
Yes.
Like every day, those norms are imposed upon us. And you actually have to work incredibly hard and you have to have such a strong sense of self to be able to survive it, period, let alone to thrive in it, which is, of course, what we deserve. And so this idea, you know, and so many people now are like, you know, they're forcing transgenderism upon us. I mean, like, but what does that, like, what are you talking about? You know, and I think too, it's just this fear of being around people who represent an expansiveness that you don't want to see because you haven't looked at yourself. And not to say that, oh, you're hiding a transness or anything else, but rather it's that it is scary for people to ask questions, that there is sort of this deep anxiety that people have with unlimited possibilities, and that structure is stabilizing in a certain way. That people, I think, in a world that can feel deeply destabilizing for everyone, and I acknowledge that, that, you know, possibility is scary. And I just want to say one thing, going back to the many experiences of transness, and one of the things that is so destructive about the totally and completely weaponized detransition narrative is that the majority of people who detransition, and that term has an unbelievably wide range of meanings.
Absolutely.
Don't regret their experience.
Yes.
And are fine. I did this and now I feel like this. That is the most common narrative of what might be called detransition. And then there are the other people who say quite clearly, I detransitioned because of societal discrimination. And so what's lost is the many experiences of both transition and detransition. And then the reality, of course, that the overwhelming majority of people do not detransition in any definition of the word and have no regret. And in fact, I mean, for me, I say every single day that having top surgery was probably the best day of my life. I will never forget it. I will fight every single day of my life to make sure that other people have access to that experience of embodiment that I have and whatever it means to them. And that just feels so important to me.
We both know that transgenderism isn't truly a word that the trans community uses very frequently because ism is a belief system or something subject to change, which being trans is not. But I was just thinking, like, what if transgenderism is not being trans, but rather the belief that trans people exist and that gender is more expansive? And in that case, maybe we should force transgenderism on everybody. And the forcing, or the invitation, actually, is really what I would like to call it. The encouragement is, hey, maybe there's more to you than you have been told. And actually, I'm going to change that to say there definitely is more to you than you've been told, or than you believe that you are allowed to have access to. And I think that there's something so beautiful that most trans people know that inherently. We have to, in order to be able, you know, by default, to say that we're trans. But can we invite other people into that contagion, or whatever you want to call it? But I actually, one of the things I want for all of my friends who are not trans, who are cisgender, is actually to ask themselves, How am I myself? How can I be more of myself? How can I not be only what I'm told to be? And what power is released when we do that? But the power then is concentrated in the person, in the individual, and not in the government.
Right.
So I was just curious in the as we end now, if there's anything else you want to share specifically towards allies, to people who are not trans, and how they can sort of harness that power for themselves as well, kind of what Megan Rapinoe was talking about in terms of that gratefulness for that expansiveness.
Yeah, I mean, I think first, going back to what you were saying about, you know, what is this, you know, sort of construct of transgenderism, and can we, you know, reframe it? Mm-hmm. Globally, one of the things that, you know, the right, and it originated in the Catholic Church, it's claiming to be opposed to, is quote unquote gender ideology. Right. And what they mean by that is any disruption of, you know, Christian, heterosexual, cisgender norms of family, desire, sex. And so Yes, I want there to be ideologies of gender that ask us, how do we feel alive and how can we experience care in our body and love in our body and desire and not have that be grounded in shame or fear or violence? And so what I really want is for everyone to ask themselves more questions. I think so many things about life will be more enriching if we can do that instead of being presumptive. And one of the things in the pandemic that I experienced was just an unbelievable gratitude that I was parenting and living in a queer structure that didn't fall back on heteronormative gender norms in which caretaking labor is so disproportionately held by women, and where, you know, all household and domestic caregiving is so deeply rooted in systems of supremacy. And how beautiful is it when queerness or transness or whatever system we get to be a part of disrupts those deeply destructive historical ideologies of gender, and that what we're facing from whether it's the Catholic Church or Empire or the United States government is a real a sort of powerful desire to re-entrench those norms. And so what I want to say to allies is, don't you want to be a part of the world that we are ushering in rather than the other one?
Don't you want to be a part of a world that thinks beyond these systems, yeah, right? Don't you want to be a part of a world that imagines, that dreams, and that that creates a legacy that, yeah, that we actually want to embody? Chase, thank you so much for spending the time. It's always lovely. And I, like you said earlier, I love to spend time with queer and trans folks as much as possible. And you've always felt like community to me. So I'm just really grateful. Thank you.
I'm so grateful that Chase took the time out of his very busy schedule to sit down with us. Chase spends so much of his time fighting these anti-trans laws in court, doing so much important work that I personally am grateful for, that so many of us are grateful for as trans people trying to live our lives. And so I'm just so glad that he had the time to come and talk with us. So let's answer our question directly. Why are there so many anti-trans bills? In short, these anti-trans bills are not here alone, and they didn't pop up out of nowhere. They've been building for a long time, and not even, you know, recently a long time, right? Not the recent decades that we've been seeing anti-trans legislation, but it's even before that, built off of a constitution, as Chase mentioned, a constitution that was built to protect slavery, right? A constitution that was built to encroach upon bodily autonomy of people specifically who are marginalized. Anti-trans legislation is a part of an attack on freedom, on personal abilities to live in one's body, no matter who you are. Anti-trans legislation is happening in concert with anti-Black legislation, anti-Indigenous legislation, colonial legislation, and colonial practices around the whole world. There is so much going on right now in this country and beyond that is attacking people's right to self-determination and bodily autonomy, and specifically those peoples who are marginalized, who are Black and brown, trans and queer, and so on. And for this reason, fighting anti-trans legislation is actually a collective fight, right? It's a fight against white supremacy. It's a fight against anti-Blackness. It's a fight against deadly settler colonialism. Fighting transphobia is a collective fight because all of us can be liberated by trans liberation. Thanks so much for joining us for this episode of Dear Skylar. We'll see you in a couple weeks.